with Katerina in a small apartment. I told my parents of Arya's death and that I was Diana now. They replied that they had told the council that David was the one who had died, that they loved me and understood, but that I must live in the mundane world now, for I was seeing mundane doctors, and that was against the law. It was too late for me to stop them. The Clave was told that David had died out on the island, fighting revenants. They gave David my sister's death, a death with honor. I wish they had not lied, but if they had to wear white for the boy who was gone, even if he'd never really existed, I couldn't deny them that. Katerina had worked as a nurse for years. She knew mundane medicine. She brought me to a clinic in Bangkok. I met others like myself there. I wasn't alone any longer. I was there for 3 years. I never planned to be a shadow hunter again. What I was gaining was too precious. I couldn't risk being discovered, having my secrets flayed open, being called by a man's name, having who I was denied. Through the years, Katerina guided me through the mundane medical procedure that gave me the body in whose skin I could feel comfortable. She hid my unusual test results from the doctors so they would never be puzzled by my shadow hunter blood. "Mundane medicine," Gwyn echoed. "It is forbidden, is it not, for a shadow hunter to seek out mundane medical treatment? Why did Katerina not simply use magic to aid you?" Diana shook her head. "I wouldn't have wanted that," she said. "A magic spell can always be undone by another spell. I will not have the truth of myself be something that can be dissolved by a stray enchantment or passing through the wrong magical gate. My body is my body. The body I have grown into as a woman, as all women grow into their bodies." Gwyn nodded, though Diana couldn't tell if he understood. "So, that is what you fear," was all he said. "I'm not afraid for myself," said Diana. "I'm afraid for the children. As long as I'm their tutor, I feel like I can protect them in some way. If the Clave knew what I'd done, that I sought out mundane doctors, I'd wind up in prison under the Silent City, or in the Basileus if they were being kind." "And your parents?" Gwyn's face was unreadable. Diana wished he would give her some kind of sign. Was he angry? Would he mock her? His calmness was making her pulse race. "Did they come to you? You must have missed them."
"I feared to expose them to the Clave." Diana's voice hitched. "Each time they spoke of a clandestine visit to Bangkok, I put them off. And then the news came that they had died, slain in a demon attack. Katerina was the one who told me. I wept all night. I could not tell my mundane friends of my parents' death because they would not understand why I didn't return home for the funeral. Then news came of the mortal war, and I realized I was still a shadow hunter. I could not let Idris suffer peril without a fight. I returned to Alicante. I told the council I was the daughter of Aaron and Lyssa Rayburn, because that was the truth. They knew there had been a brother and a sister, and the brother had died. I gave my name as Diana. In the chaos of war, no one questioned me. I rose up as Diana in battle. I fought as myself, with a sword in my hand and angel fire in my veins. And I knew I could never go back to being a mundane. Among my mundane friends, I had to conceal the existence of shadow hunters. Among the shadow hunters, I had to hide that I had once used mundane medicine. I knew either way I would have to hide part of myself. I chose to be a shadow hunter. Who else knows all this, besides Katerina? Malcolm knew. There is a medicine I must take to maintain the balance of my body's hormones. I usually get it from Katerina, but there was a time she couldn't do it and had Malcolm make it. After that, he knew. He never directly held it over my head, but I was always aware of his knowledge, that he could hurt me. "That he could hurt you," Gwyn murmured. His face was a mask. Diana could hear her heart beating in her ears. It was as if she'd come to Gwyn with her heart in her hands, raw and bleeding, and now she waited for him to produce the knives. All my life, I've tried to find a place to be myself, and I'm still looking for it, said Diana. Because of that, I have hidden things from people I loved, and I have hidden this from you. But I have never lied about the truth of myself. What Gwyn did next surprised Diana. He rose up from the bed, took a step forward, and went down on his knees in front of her. He did it gracefully, the way a squire might kneel to a knight, or a knight to his lady. There was something ancient in the essence of the gesture, something that went back to the heart of the core of the folk of Faerie.
It is as I knew, he said. When I saw you upon the stairs of the Institute, and I saw the fire in your eyes, I knew you were the bravest woman ever to set foot on this earth. I regret only that such a fearless soul was ever hurt by the ignorance and fear of others.
Gwyn,
may I hold you? He asked. She nodded. She couldn't speak. She knelt down opposite the leader of the wild hunt and let him take her into his broad arms, let him stroke her hair and murmur her name in his voice that still sounded like the rumble of thunder. But now it was thunder heard from inside a warm, closed house, where everyone was safe inside.
Tavi was the first one to sense Emma and Julian's return when they portaled back into the Institute library with Magnus. He had been sitting on the floor, systematically dismantling some old toys with the assistance of Max. The moment Julian felt the floor solid under his feet, Tavi bounded upright and careened toward him, crashing into him like a train that had gone off its tracks.
"Jules!" he exclaimed, and Julian swung him up into his arms and crushed him in a hug as Tavi clung to him and babbled about what he'd seen and eaten and done in the past few days. And Jules ruffled his brother's hair and felt a tension he hadn't even known he was carrying go out of him. Christina had been sitting with Rafe, talking to him quietly in Spanish. Mark was at the library table with Alec, and, to Julian's surprise, Kieran, a mass of books open in front of them. Christina jumped to her feet and ran to hug Emma. Livy came barreling into the room, Ty following more quietly after, and Julian lowered Tavi to the ground, where he remained by Julian's side, gripping his leg, while he greeted the rest of his family in a blur of hugs and exclamations. Emma was hugging the twins, a sight that sent a dart of familiar pain through Julian's ribcage. The dread of separation, of pulling apart what belonged together, the dream of his family, Emma as his partner, the children, their responsibility. A hand touched his shoulder, jolting him out of imagination. It was Mark, who looked at him with uneasiness.
Jules?
Of course. Mark didn't realize Julian knew the truth about him and Emma. He looked worried, hopeful, like a puppy who had come begging for scraps but half expected to be slapped away from the table.
Was I that bad?
Julian wondered, guilt spearing through him. Mark hadn't even known, hadn't imagined Julian loving Emma. Had been horrified when he found out. Mark and Emma loved each other, but not romantically, which was what Julian would have wanted. His heart swelled with tenderness toward both of them, for everything they had given up to protect him, for being willing to let him hate them, if that was what it took. He drew Mark with him into a corner of the room. The hubbub of greeting went on all around them as Julian lowered his voice.
I know what you did, he said. I know you were never really dating Emma. I'm grateful. I know it was for me.
Mark looked surprised.
It was Emma's idea, he said.
Oh, believe me, I know. Julian put his hand on his brother's shoulder. And you did a good job with the kids. Magnus told me. Thank you.
Mark's face lit up. It made Julian's heart ache even harder.
I mean, they got in so much trouble.
You loved them and you kept them alive, said Julian. Sometimes that's the best anyone can do. Julian pulled his brother toward him into a hard hug. Mark made a muffled noise of surprise before his own arms went around Julian, half crushing the breath out of him.
Julian could feel his brother's heart hammering against his, as if the same relief and joy were beating through their shared blood. They drew apart after a moment.
"So, you and Emma," Mark began half-hesitantly.
But before Julian could reply, Livy had thrown herself at them, somehow managing to hug Julian and Mark at the same time, and the conversation vanished into laughter. Ty came more diffidently after her, smiling and touching Julian on the shoulder and then the hand as if to make sure he was really there. Tactile expression meant as much to Ty as what he could observe with his eyes. Mark was telling Emma that Drew was still in her room, but that she'd come shortly. Magnus had gone to Alec, and the two were talking quietly by the fireplace. Only Kieran remained where he was, so silent and still at the table that he could have been a decorative plant. The sight of him flicked a memory in Julian's mind, though, and he looked around for blonde hair and a sarcastic expression. "Where's Kit?" A flood of cross-explanations followed, the story of the riders at the riverside, the way Gwyn and Diana had saved them, Kit's injury. Emma described the four riders they'd encountered in Cornwall, though it was Julian who detailed the way Emma had killed one of them, which prompted a great deal of exclaiming.
"I've never heard of anyone killing a rider before," said Christina, hurrying to the table to pick up a book. "But someone must have."
"No." It was Kieran, his voice even and quiet. There was something in the timbre of it that reminded Julian of the Unseelie King's voice.
"No one ever has.
There have only ever been seven, the children of Manon, and they have lived almost since the beginning of time."
"There must be something very special about you, Emma Carstairs."
Emma flushed.
"There isn't."
Kieran was still looking at Emma, curiously. He was wearing jeans and a cream-colored sweater. He looked alarmingly human until you really examined his face and the uncanniness of his bone structure.
"What was it like to kill something so old?"
Emma hesitated.
"It was like... Have you ever held ice so long in your hand that the coldness hurt your skin?"
After a pause, Kieran nodded.
"It is a deathly pain." "It was like that."
"So we're safe here," Julian said to Magnus, partly to forestall any further questions about the dead rider. "In the Institute." "The riders can't reach us here. They're warded away," said Magnus.
"But Gwyn was able to land on the roof," Emma said. "So fair folk can't be completely shut out."
"Gwyn is the Wild Hunt. They're different." Magnus reached down to pick up Max, who giggled and pulled at his scarf. "Also, I doubled the wards around the Institute since this afternoon."
"Where's Diana?" said Julian.
"She went back to Idris.
She says she has to keep Gia and the council happy and calm and expecting this meeting to take place with no hiccups."
"But we don't have the Black Volume," said Julian.
"Well, we still have a day and a half," said Emma, "to find Annabelle." "Without leaving these hallowed halls," Mark said. He sat down on the arm of one of the chairs. "We are kind of trapped."
"I don't know if the riders realize Alec and I are here," Magnus said.
"Or perhaps we could prevail on Gwyn."
"The danger seems pretty severe," said Emma. "We wouldn't feel right asking for that kind of help."
"Well, I'm going back to Idris with the kids. I can certainly see what I can do from there."
Alec flung himself down in a chair near Rafe and ruffled the boy's dark hair. Maybe Alec could get into Blackthorn Manor, Julian thought. He was exhausted, nerves frayed from one of the best and worst days of his life. But Blackthorn Manor was probably the place on Earth Annabelle had loved the most. His mind began to tick over the possibilities.
"Annabelle cared about Blackthorn Manor," he said. "Not Blackthorn Hall, here in London. The family didn't own that yet. The one in Idris, she loved it."
"So you think she might be there?" said Magnus.
"No," said Julian. "She hates the Clave, hates Shadow Hunters. She'd be too afraid to go to Idris. I was just thinking that if it was in danger, if it was threatened, she might be called out of where she's hiding."
He could tell Emma was wondering why he wasn't mentioning that he'd seen Annabelle in Cornwall. He wondered it a bit himself, but his instincts told him to keep it secret a little longer.
"Are you suggesting we burn down Blackthorn Manor?" said Ty, his eyebrows up around his hairline.
"Oddly," Magnus muttered, "you wouldn't be the first people to ever have that idea."
Ty, don't get so excited, Livy said. Pyromania interests me, said Ty.
I think you have to burn down several buildings before you can consider yourself to be an actual maniac for pyro, Emma said. I think before that you're just an enthusiast.
I think setting a large fire in Idris will attract attention we don't want, said Mark.
I think we don't have a lot of choices, said Julian.
And I think we should eat, Livy said hastily, patting her stomach. I'm starving.
We can discuss what we know, especially regarding Annabelle and the Black Volume, said Ty. We can pool our information.
Magnus glanced fleetingly at Alec.
After we eat, we need to send the children to Idris. Diane is standing by on the other side to help us keep the portal open, but I don't want her to have to wait too long.
It was kind of him, Julian thought, to phrase it as if sending the children to Alicante was a favor Magnus was doing for Diana, rather than a precaution taken to protect them. Tavi skipped along with Rafe and Max to the dining room, and Julian felt a pang, realizing how much his little brother had missed having friends close to his own age, even if he hadn't known it.
Jules?
He glanced down and saw that Drew was walking beside him. Her face was pale in the corridor's witchlight.
Yeah?
He resisted the urge to pat her cheek or pull her braids. She'd stopped appreciating that when she was 10.
I don't want to go to Alicante, she said. I want to stay here with you.
Drew, she hunched her shoulders up.
You were younger than me in the Dark War, she said. I'm 13. You can send the babies where it's safe, but not me. I'm a Blackthorn, just like you.
So is Tavi.
He's 7.
Drew took in a shaky breath.
You make me feel like I'm not part of this family.
Julian stopped dead. Drew stopped with him, and they both watched as the others went into the dining room. Julian could hear Bridget scolding them all. Apparently she'd been holding dinner for them for hours, though it had never occurred to her to find them and tell them so.
Drew, he said, do you really want to stay?
She nodded.
I really want to.
Then that's all you have to say. You can stay with us.
She threw herself into his arms.
Drew wasn't a huggy sort of person, and for a moment Julian was too surprised to move. Then he put his arms around his sister and tightened them against the flood of memories. Baby Drew, sleeping in his arms, taking her first toddling steps, laughing as Emma held her over the water at the beach, barely getting her toes wet.
You're the heart of this family, baby girl, he said in the voice that only his brothers and sisters ever heard. I promise you, you're our heart.
Bridget had somewhat haphazardly set out cold chicken, bread, cheese, vegetables, and banoffee pie. Kieran picked at the vegetables while the rest of them talked over each other to lay out what they knew. Emma sat beside Julian. Every once in a while their shoulders would bump or their hands collide as they reached for something. Each touch sent a shower of sparks through him, like a small explosion of fireworks. Ty, his elbows on the table, took point on the discussion, explaining how he, Kit, and Livy had found the Alethea crystal and the memories trapped within it. 200 years ago, Malcolm and Annabelle broke into the Cornwall Institute, he explained, his graceful hands slicing through the air as he talked. Something seemed different about Ty, Julian thought, though how could his brother have changed in the few short days he'd been away? They stole the Black Volume, but they were caught.
Do we know why they wanted it? Christina asked.
I do not see how necromancy could have helped them.
They plan to trade it to someone else, it looks like, said Emma.
The book wasn't for them. Someone had promised to trade them protection from the clave for it.
It was a time when a relationship between a shadow hunter and a downworlder could have meant a death sentence for both of them, said Magnus. Protection would have been a very attractive offer.
They never got that far, Ty said. They were both caught and thrown in prison in the Silent City, and the Black Volume was taken from them and returned to the Cornwall Institute. Then something weird happened. He frowned. Ty didn't like not knowing things.
Malcolm disappeared. He left Annabelle to be questioned and tortured.
He wouldn't have done that willingly, said Julian. He loved her.
People can betray even those they love, said Mark.
No, Julian's right, said Emma. I hate Malcolm more than anyone, but he absolutely would never have left Annabelle.
She was his whole life.
It's still what happened, said Ty.
They tortured Annabelle for information until she pretty much lost her mind, said Livy. Then they released her to her family. And they killed her and told everyone she'd become an Iron Sister. But it wasn't true.
There was a tightness in Julian's throat. He thought of Annabelle's drawings, the lightness in them, the hope, the love for Blackthorn Manor and Idris, and for Malcolm.
Fast forward almost 100 years, said Emma. Malcolm goes to the Unseelie King. He's found that Annabelle wasn't an Iron Sister, that she was murdered. He's out for bloody vengeance.
She paused, combing her fingers back through her hair, still tangled from Cornish wind and rain.
The Unseelie King tells him how to raise Annabelle, but there's a catch. Malcolm needs the Black Volume to do it, and now he doesn't have it. It's in the Cornwall Institute. He broke in there once, but he doesn't dare do it again. So there it stays until the Blackthorns who run the Institute move to Los Angeles, and they take it with them.
Ty's eyes lit up.
Right. And Malcolm sees his chance when Sebastian Morgenstern attacks and takes the book. He starts to raise Annabelle, and finally he succeeds.
Except she's pissed off and kills him, said Emma.
How ungrateful, said Karen.
Ungrateful, Emma said. He was a murderer. She was right to kill him.
He may have been a murderer, said Kieran, but it sounds like it became one for her. He killed to give her life.
Maybe she didn't want life, said Alec. He shrugged. He never did ask her what she wanted, did he?
As if sensing the tense atmosphere at the table, Max began to wail. With a sigh, Alec picked him up and carried him out of the room.
I'm sure it's useful to know all this, said Magnus. But does it bring us closer to the Black Volume?
Maybe if we had more time, and the writers weren't after us, said Julian.
I think, said Kieran slowly, his gaze unfocused, that it was my father.
Apparently it was his day for startling pronouncements. Everyone stared at him again. To Julian's surprise, it was Christina who spoke.
What do you mean, it was your father?
I think he was the one who wanted the book all those years ago, when Malcolm first stole it, said Kieran. He's the thread that ties all this together. He wanted the book then, and he wants it now.
But why do you think he wanted it then? Julian said. He kept his voice low and gentle, what Emma thought of as his leading the witness voice.
Because of something Adain said. Kieran was looking down at his hands.
He said my father had wanted the book since the first heir was stolen. 'Tis an old story in Faerie. The theft of my father's first child. It happened more than 200 years ago.
Christina looked stunned.
I didn't realize that's what he meant.
The first heir. Magnus's eyes looked unfocused.
I have heard that tale, or heard of it. The child was not just stolen, but murdered.
So the story goes, said Kieran. Perhaps my father wished to use necromancy to raise the child. I could not speak of his motives.
But he could have offered Fade and Annabelle protection in the Unseelie Lands. No shadow hunter could touch them if they were safe and fairy.
Emma set down her fork with a clang.
Pretentious hair prince is right.
Kieran blinked.
What do you call me?
I'm trying it out, Emma said with a wave. And I said you were right. Enjoy it, because I doubt I'll say it again.
Magnus nodded.
The king is one of the few beings on this earth who could have kidnapped Malcolm from the prisons of Silent City. He must not have wanted him to reveal their connection to the council.
But why didn't he take Annabelle too?
Livy asked, a forkful of pie halfway to her mouth.
Because maybe Malcolm had disappointed him by getting caught, said Mark. Maybe he wanted to punish them both.
But Annabelle could have told on them, said Livy. She could have said Malcolm was working for the king.
Not if she didn't know, said Emma. There was nothing in the diaries Malcolm kept that mentioned who he was stealing the book for, and I bet he didn't tell Annabelle either.
They tortured her, said Ty, and she still didn't say who it was, just that she had no idea. It must have been the truth.
That explains why when he found out Annabelle wasn't an Iron Sister that he'd been lied to, Malcolm went to see the Unseelie King, said Julian, because he knew him.
So, once the king wanted the book for necromancy, said Christina. Now he wants it so he can destroy Shadowhunters.
Not all necromancy is raising the dead.
Magnus was gazing at the glass of wine by his plate, as if there was some kind of secret hidden in its depth.
One moment, he said, and scooped up Rafe from the chair beside him. He turned to Tavi. Would you like to come with us and play with Alexander and Max?
After a glance at Julian, Tavi nodded. The group of them left the room, Magnus gesturing he would be right back.
This was just one meeting, said Emma. First, we need to get the council to believe that the Unseelie Court is an immediate threat. Right now, they can't tell good fairies from bad and aren't interested in trying.
Which is where Kieran's testimony comes in, said Mark. And there is some evidence.
There's the blight, Diana said she saw in Brosselin Forest, and the report from the Shadow Hunters who said they fought a band of fairies, but their weapons malfunctioned.
It's not a lot to go on, said Livy. Especially considering Zara and her nasty little band of bigots. They are going to try to seize power at this meeting. They're going to try to grab the Institute. They couldn't care less about some vague fairy threat.
I can make the Clave fear my father, said Kieran. But it may take all of us to make them understand that if they do not wish for a new era of darkness, they must abandon their dreams of extending the Cold Peace.
No registering warlocks, said Ty. No putting werewolves into camps.
The Downworlders who have seats on the council all know about the cohort, said Magnus, returning without the children.
If it actually comes down to a vote about who heads the Los Angeles Institute, they'll have to bring in Maya and Lily, as well as me. We're entitled to vote.
He threw himself down in a chair at the head of the table.
That's still just three votes, even if you vote against the cohort, said Julian.
It's a tricky business, Magnus agreed. According to Diana, Gia doesn't want Zara heading up the Los Angeles Institute any more than we do. She'll be hard to discredit at the moment. With her lie about killing Malcolm, she's pretty popular right now.
Emma made a growling noise, low in her throat. Christina patted her hand.
Meanwhile, what we have is the promise that the Queen will fight with us against a threat the Council is unlikely to believe in. And even then, only if she gets a book we don't currently have, and wouldn't be allowed to give her if we did. Magnus said.
Our bargain with the Seelie Queen is our business, said Julian. Right now we say she's shown herself willing to cooperate under the right circumstances. Kieran's empowered to promise she'll help. He doesn't need to go into details.
Brother, you think like a fairy, said Mark, in a tone that made Julian wonder if that was a good thing or not.
Maybe the king wants to raise an army of the dead, said Drew, hopefully. I mean, it is a book of necromancy.
Magnus sighed, tapping a fingernail against his glass thoughtfully.
Necromancy is about doing magic that uses the energy of death to power it. All magic needs fuel. Death energy is incredibly powerful fuel. It's also incredibly destructive. The destruction of the land that you saw in Faerie, the blight in Brosselin, they are the scars left by terrible magic. The question remains, what is his ultimate goal?
You mean he needs more energy to spread those spells, said Julian. The ones that Malcolm helped with, that cancel out Shadowhunter magic.
I mean your magic is angelic in its nature, said Magnus. It comes from light, from energy and life. The opposite of that is Sheol, hell, whatever you want to call it. The absence of light in life, of any kind of hope. He coughed.
When the council voted for the Cold Peace, they were voting for a time that never existed, just as the cohort wishes everything to return to a lost golden age, when Shadowhunters walked the world like gods and Downworlders and mundanes bowed before them.
Everyone stared at him. This was a Magnus Bane people rarely saw, Julian thought, a Magnus whose good cheer and casual optimism had deserted him. A Magnus who was remembering the darkness of all he had seen over the centuries, the death and the loss. The same Magnus Julian had seen in the Hall of Accords when he was 12, begging the council in vain not to pass the Cold Peace, knowing that they would.
The king wants the same, to unite two kingdoms that have always been separate, but in his mind were one land once.
We must stop the king, but in a way he's only doing what the cohort would do.
what we have to hope the Clave would not do.
You mean, said Julian, this is vengeance?
Magnus shrugged.
It is the whirlwind, he said. Let us hope we can stop it.
Chapter 26 Walk in Shadow. Emma sat on Christina's bed, brushing her friend's hair. She was beginning to understand why her mother had loved brushing her hair so much when she was a little girl. There was something oddly soothing about the smooth, dark locks slipping through her fingers, the repetitive motion of the brush. It soothed the ache in her head, her chest, the one that felt like not just her own pain, but Julian's. She knew how much he hated saying goodbye to Tavi, even if it was for Tavi's own good, and she felt a hollowness inside herself, where Julian was parting from his smallest brother now. Being with Christina helped. Emma had spilled everything that happened in Cornwall while clucking over Christina's wrist and rubbing a mundane cream called Savlon into the red mark from the binding room. Christina ouched and complained that it stung and handed Emma a hairbrush and told her to do something actually useful.
So does anything help the binding? Said Emma. Like if Mark came in here and lay down directly on top of you, would the pain go away?
Yes, said Christina, sounding a bit muffled.
Well, it's very inconsiderate of him not to, if you ask me. Christina gave out a little wail that sounded like,
Kieran.
Right. Mark has to pretend he still cares about Kieran. I guess lying on top of you wouldn't do much for that.
He does still care about Kieran, Christina said. It's just, I think he cares about me, too.
She half turned to look at Emma. Her eyes were big and dark and worried.
I danced with him, with Mark, and we kissed.
That's good.
That is good, right?
It was. But then Kieran came in.
What?
But he wasn't angry. He just told Mark that he should dance better, and he danced with me.
It was like dancing with fire.
Whoa, sexy weirdness, said Emma. This may be more sexy weirdness than I can handle.
It's not weird.
It is, said Emma. You're headed for a fairy threesome or some kind of war.
Emma!
Hot fairy threesome, said Emma cheerfully. I can say I knew you when. Christina groaned.
Fine. What about you and Julian? Do you have a plan after what happened in Cornwall?
Emma sighed and put the hairbrush down. It was a lovely old silverbacked Victorian object. She wondered if it had been in the room when Christina got here, or if she'd found it somewhere else in the Institute. Already Christina's London room bore signs of her personality. Pictures had been cleaned and straightened. She'd found a colorful coverlet for her bed somewhere, and her Bali song hung on a new hook by the fireplace. Emma began to braid Christina's hair, plaiting the thick strands between her fingers.
"We don't have a plan," she said. "It's always the same thing. We're together, and we feel like we're invincible. Then we start to realize it's still all the same choices, and they're all bad ones."
Christina looked troubled.
"It is always the same choices, isn't it? Separation from each other, or ceasing to be shadow hunters?"
Emma had finished the braid. She leaned her chin on Christina's shoulder, thinking about what Julian had learned from the Seely Queen, the terrifying possibility of ending all parabatai bonds. But it was too horrible a thing to even voice out loud.
"I used to think it would help, physical distance from Julian," she said. "But now I don't think it would. Nothing else has. I think no matter where I went or for how long, I would always feel like this." "Some loves are very strong, like cords. They bind you," said Christina. "The Bible says love is as strong as death. I believe that."
Emma scooted around to peer closer into her friend's face. "Christina," she said, "there's something else going on, isn't there? Something about Diego, or Jaime?" Christina looked down.
"I can't say."
"Let me help you," Emma said. "You're always so strong for everyone else. Let me be strong for you." There was a knock on the door. They both looked up in surprise.
"Mark," Emma thought.
It was something about the look in Christina's face. It must be Mark. But it was Kieran. Emma froze in surprise. Though she'd grown somewhat used to Kieran being around, he still made the fine hairs on Emma's arms rise with tension.
It wasn't that she blamed him, specifically, for the injury she'd suffered at Irloth's hands, but the sight of him still brought it back to her, all of it. The hot sun, the sound of the whip, the copper scent of blood. It was true that he looked enormously different now. His black hair was a little wilder, more untidy, but otherwise he cut an incongruously human figure in his jeans. The wild hair hid the tops of his pointed ears, though his black and silver eyes were still startling. He gave a small, courtly bow.
"My ladies."
Christina looked puzzled. Clearly she hadn't expected this visit either.
"I came to speak with Christina, if she will permit it," Kieran added.
"Go ahead then," Emma said. "Speak."
"I think he wishes to speak to me alone," said Christina in a whisper.
"Yes," said Kieran. "That is my request."
Christina looked at Emma.
"I'll see you in the morning, then?"
"Huh," Emma thought. She'd missed Christina, and now a brash fairy princeling was kicking her out of her friend's room. Kieran barely spared her a glance as she climbed off the bed and headed to the door. As she passed Kieran on her way out, Emma paused, her shoulder almost touching his.
"If you do anything to hurt or upset her,"
she said in a voice low enough that she doubted Christina could hear it,
"I will pull off your ears and turn them into lock picks. Get it?"
Kieran glanced at her with his night sky eyes, unreadable as clouds.
"No," he said.
"Let me spell it out," Emma said sharply. "I love her. Don't mess around with her."
Kieran put his long, delicate hands in his pockets. He looked absolutely unnatural in his modern clothes. It was like seeing Alexander the Great in a biker jacket and leather pants. "She is easy to love." Emma looked at him in surprise. It hadn't been what she'd expected him to say at all.
Easy to love.
Neen had behaved as if the concept was bizarre. But then, what did the fair folk know about love, anyway?
"Would you like to sit down?"
Christina inquired. Then she wondered if she was turning into her mother, who had always claimed that the first thing one did with a guest was to offer them a seat.
"Even if they were a murderer?"
Christina had asked.
"Yes, even murderers," her mother had insisted.
"If you didn't offer a murderer a seat, you shouldn't have invited him in the first place." "No," said Kieran. He moved across the room, hands in his pockets, his body language restless.
Not unlike Mark's, Christina thought. They both moved as if they had energy trapped beneath their skin. She wondered what it would be like to contain so much movement and yet be forced to stay still.
"Milady," he said, "because of what I swore to you in the Seely Court, there is a bond between us. I think you have felt its force."
Christina nodded. It wasn't the enchanted bond she had with Mark, but it was there, anyway, a shimmering energy when they danced, when they spoke.
"I think that force can help us do something together I cannot do alone."
Kieran came closer to the bed, drawing his hand out of his pocket. Something glimmered in his palm. He held it out to Christina, and she saw the acorn there that Mark had used earlier to summon Gwyn. It looked slightly dented, but it was whole, as if it had been sealed back together after breaking open.
"You want to summon Gwyn again?"
Christina shook her head. Her hair fell completely out of its unfastened braid, spilling down her back. She saw Kieran glance at it.
"No, he won't interfere again. You want to speak to someone else in Faerie, your brother?"
"As a thought," he inclined his head slightly. "You guess my intentions exactly."
"And you can do it? The acorn won't just call Gwyn?"
"The magic is a fairly simple one. Remember, you are not of the blood that can cast spells, but I am. It should bring a projection of my brother to us. I will ask him of our father's plans. I shall ask him as well if he can stop the riders."
Christina was astonished.
"Can anyone stop the riders?"
"They are servants of the court, and under its command."
"Why are you telling me this?" Christina asked.
"Because, to summon my brother, I must reach out with my mind into Faerie," said Kieran. "And it would be safer, should I wish to keep my mind intact, for me to have a connection here in the world.
something, someone, to keep me anchored while I seek my brother.
Christina slid off the bed. Standing straight, she was only a little shorter than Kieran. Her eyes were level with his mouth.
Why me? Why not Mark?
I have asked enough of Mark, he said.
Perhaps, she said. But even if that is true, I do not think it is the whole truth.
Few of us are lucky enough to ever know the whole truth of anything. She knew Kieran was young, but there was something ancient in his eyes when he spoke.
Will you put your hand in mine?
She gave him the hand whose wrist bore the red mark of her bond with Mark. It seemed fitting somehow. His fingers closed around hers, cool and dry, light as the touch of a leaf. With his other hand, Kieran dashed the golden acorn against the wall beside the fireplace mantel. For a moment, there was silence. Christina could hear his ragged breathing. It seemed strange for a fairy. Everything they did was at such a remove from ordinary human emotion. It was odd to hear Kieran gasp. But then she remembered his arms around her, the uneven thud of his heart. They were flesh and blood, after all, weren't they? Bone and muscle, just as shadow hunters were. And the flame of angelic blood burned in them, too. Darkness spread across the wall like a stain. Christina sucked in her breath, and Kieran's hand tightened on hers. The darkness moved and shivered and trembled and reformed. Light danced within it, and Christina could see the multicolored night sky of faery. And within the shadow, a darker shadow, a man wrapped in a dark cloak. As the darkness lightened, Christina saw his grin before she saw anything else, and her heart seemed to stop. It was a grin of bones set within a skeletal half-face, beautiful on one side, deathly on the other. The cloak that wrapped him was ink-black and wore the insignia of a broken crown. He stood straight and broad, grinning his lopsided grin down at Kieran. They had not summoned a Daean at all. It was the Unseelie King.
No! No!
Tabby wept, his face buried in Julian's shoulder. He'd taken the news that he was going to Idris with Alec, Max, and Rafe worse than Mark had expected. Did all children cry like this? Like everything in the world was ruined and their hearts were broken, even at the news of a short parting? Not that Mark blamed Tabby, of course. It was only that he felt as if his own heart was being shredded into pieces inside his chest as he watched Julian walk up and down the room, holding his small brother in his arms, as Tabby sobbed and pounded his back. "Tavs," Julian said in his gentle voice, the voice Mark could hardly reconcile with the boy who had faced down the Unseelie King in his own court with a knife to a prince's throat. "It's only going to be a day, 2 days at most. You get to see the canals at Alicante, the guard."
"You keep leaving," Tabby choked against his brother's shirt front. "You can't leave again."
Julian sighed. He dipped his chin, rubbing his cheek against his brother's unruly curls. Over Tavi's head, his eyes met Mark's. There was no blame in them, no self-pity, only a terrible sadness. Yet Mark felt as if guilt were crushing his ribcage. "If only were wasted words," Kieran had once said, when Mark had speculated on whether the two of them would ever have met if they had never joined the hunt. But he couldn't stop the flood of if-onlys now. If only he had been able to stay with his family. If only Julian hadn't needed to be mother and father and brother to all the younger ones. If only Tavi hadn't grown up in the shadow of death and loss. Perhaps then, every parting would not feel like the last one. "It's not your fault," said Magnus, who had appeared noiselessly at Mark's side. "You can't help the past. We grow up with losses. All of us, except the supremely lucky."
"I cannot help wishing my brother had been one of the supremely lucky," said Mark. "You can understand."
Magnus glanced toward Jules and Tavi. The little boy cried himself out and was clinging to his older brother, his face mashed against Julian's shoulder. His small shoulders were slumped in exhaustion. "Which brother?"
"Both of them," said Mark. Magnus reached out and, with curious fingers, touched the glimmering arrowhead slung around Mark's neck.
"I know this material," he said. "This arrowhead once tipped the weapon of a soldier in the king's guard of the Unseelie Court."
Mark touched it, cool, cold, smooth under his fingers, unyielding like Kieran himself.
"Kieran gave it to me."
"It is precious," said Magnus. He turned as Alec called him and let the pendant fall back against Mark's chest. Alec stood with Max in his arms and Rafe by his side, along with a small duffel bag of their things. It occurred to Mark that Alec was close to the same age Mark would have been if only he had never been kidnapped by the Hunt. He wondered if he would be as mature as Alec seemed, as self-confident, as able to take care of other people as well as himself. Magnus kissed Alec and ruffled his hair with infinite tenderness. He bent to kiss Max, too, and Rafe, and straightened up to begin to create the portal. Light sparked from and between his fingers, and the air before him seemed to shimmer. Tavi had sagged into a bundle of hopelessness against Julian's chest. Jules held him closer, the muscles in his arms tensing, and murmured soothing words. Mark wanted to go over to them, but couldn't seem to make his feet move. They seemed, even in their unhappiness, a perfect unit who needed no one else. The melancholy thought vanished a moment later as pain shot up Mark's arm. He grabbed at his wrist, his fingers encountering agonizing soreness, the slickness of blood. "Something's wrong," he thought, and then, "Christina." He bolted. The portal was growing and shimmering in the center of the room. Through its half-formed door, Mark could see the outline of the demon towers as he darted by and into the corridor. Some sense in his blood told him he was getting closer to Christina as he ran, but to his surprise, the pain in his wrist didn't fade. It pulsed again and again, like the warning beam from a lighthouse. Her door was closed. He set a shoulder against it and shoved without bothering to try the knob. It flew open, and Mark half fell inside. He choked, eyes stinging. The room smelled as if something inside had been burning, something organic, like dead leaves or rotted fruit. It was dark. His eyes adjusted quickly, and he made out Christina and Kieran, both standing by the foot of the bed. Christina was clutching her balisong. A massive shadow loomed over them. No, not a shadow, Mark realized, moving closer. A projection. A projection of the king of the Unseelie Court. Both sides of his face seemed to gleam with unnatural humor, both the beautiful, kingly side and the hideous, defleshed skull.
"You thought to summon your brother," the king sneered, his gaze on Kieran. "And you thought I would not feel you reaching into Faerie, searching for one of my own. You were a fool, Kieran, and always have been."
"And what have you done to Adain?" Kieran's face was bloodless. "He knew nothing. He had no idea I planned to summon him."
"Worry not about the others," said the king. "Worry about your own life, Kieran Kingson."
"I have been Kieran Hunter for a long time," said Kieran.
The king's face darkened.
"You should be Kieran Traitor," he said. "Kieran Betrayer, Kieran Kinslayer. All are better names for you."
"He acted in self-defense," said Christina sharply. "If he hadn't killed Irek, he would have been killed himself, and he acted to protect me."
The king gave her a brief look of scorn.
"And that in itself is a traitorous act, foolish girl," he said, "placing the lives of shadow hunters above the lives of your own people. What could be worse?"
"Selling your son to the Wild Hunt? Because you were worried that people liked him better than they liked you," said Mark. "That's worse."
Christina and Kieran looked at him in astonishment. It was clear they hadn't heard him come in. The king, though, evinced no surprise.
"Mark Blackthorn," he said. "Even in his choice of lovers, my son gravitates to the enemies of his people. What does that say about him?"
"That he knows better than you who his people are," Mark said. Very deliberately, he turned his back on the king. It would have been a hanging offense in the court.
"We must get rid of him," he said in a low voice to Kieran and Christina. "Should I get Magnus?" He's only a projection, Kieran said. His face was drawn. He cannot hurt us, nor can he remain forever. It's an effort for him, I think.
Do not turn your back on me, the king roared. Do you think I do not know your plans, Kieran? Do you think I do not know you plan to stand up and betray me before the Council of Nephilim?
Kieran turned his face away, as if he couldn't bear to look at his father.
Then cease to do what I know you're doing, he said in a shaking voice. Parley with the Nephilim. Do not make war on them.
There is no parley with those who can lie, snarled the king, and have done and will do again. They will lie and spill the blood of our people. And once they are done with you, do you think they will let you live, treat you like one of them?
They have treated me better than my own father has, Kieran raised his chin.
Have they? The king's eyes were dark and empty. I took some memories from you, Kieran, when you came to my court. Shall I give them back?
Kieran looked confused.
What use could you possibly have for my memories?
Some of us would know our enemies, said the king.
Kieran, Mark said. The look in the king's eyes made fear roil in the pit of his stomach. Do not listen. He seeks to hurt you.
And what do you seek? The king demanded, turning toward Mark.
Only the fact that Mark could see through him, could see the outline of Christina's bed, her wardrobe, through the transparent frame of his body, kept him from darting toward the fireplace poker and swinging it at the king.
If only
the king had been any sort of father. If only he hadn't thrown his son to the hunt like a bone to a pack of hungry wolves. If only he hadn't sat complacently by while Arrak tortured Kieran. How different would Kieran be? How much less afraid of losing love? How much less determined to hold on to it at all costs, even if it meant trapping Mark in the hunt with him? The king's lip curled as if he could read Mark's thoughts.
When I looked into my son's memories, he said, I saw you, Blackthorn, Lady Nerissa's son.
His smile was malignant.
Your mother died of sorrow when your father left her. My son's thoughts were half of you, of the loss of you.
Mark, Mark, Mark.
I wonder what it is in your bloodline that has the power to enchant our people and make fools of them.
A small line had appeared between Kieran's brows. The loss of you. Kieran didn't remember losing Mark. The cold fear in Mark's stomach had spread to his veins.
Those who cannot love do not understand it, said Christina. She turned toward Kieran. We will protect you, she said. We won't let him harm you for testifying at the council.
Lies, said the king. Well-intentioned, perhaps, but still lies. If you testify, Kieran, there will be no place on this earth, or in Faerie, where you will be safe from me and my warriors. I will hunt you forever, and when I find you, you will wish you had died for what you did to Eorloth, to Arrak. There is no torment you can imagine that I will not visit on you.
Kieran swallowed hard, but his voice was steady.
Pain is just pain.
Oh, said his father. There is all manner of pain, little dark one.
He did not move or make any gesture the way warlocks did when they cast spells, but Mark felt an increase in the weight of the atmosphere in the room, as if the air pressure had risen. Kieran gasped and reeled back as if he'd been shot. He hit the bed, grasping at the footboard to keep himself from sliding to the floor. His hair fell over his eyes, changing from blue to black to white.
Mark.
He raised his face slowly.
I remember. I remember.
Kieran, Mark whispered.
I told Gwyn you had betrayed a Lord of Faerie, said Kieran. I thought he would only bring you back to the hunt.
Instead they punished my family, said Mark. He knew Kieran hadn't meant it to happen, hadn't anticipated it, but the words still hurt to say.
That's why you weren't wearing an elf bolt.
Kieran's eyes fixed on the point below Mark's chin.
You did not want me. You turned me away.
You hated me. You must hate me now.
I didn't hate you, Mark said. Kier.
Listen to him, murmured the king. Listen to him lie.
Then why? Kieran said. He backed away from Mark, just a step. Why did you lie to me?
Consider it, child, said the king. He looked as if he were enjoying himself. What do they want from you?
Kieran breathed in hard. Testimony, he said. Witnessing in front of the council. You planned this, Mark? This deception?
Does everyone in the Institute know?
Yes. They must.
They must.
His hair had gone black as oil. And the Queen knows too, I suppose. She planned to make a fool of me, with you.
The agony on his face was too much. Mark couldn't look at it, at Kieran. It was Christina who spoke for him.
Kieran, no, she said. It wasn't like that.
And you knew? Kieran turned a look on her that was hardly less betrayed than the one he'd turned on Mark.
You knew as well?
The king laughed. Rage went through Mark then, a blinding fury, and he seized up the poker from the fireplace. The king continued laughing as he stalked toward him, raised the poker, and swung it. It slammed against the golden acorn where it lay on the hearth before the fireplace, shattering it into powder. The king's laughter cut off abruptly. He turned a look of pure hatred on Mark and vanished.
Why did you do that? Kieran demanded. Were you afraid of what else he would tell me?
Mark threw the poker against the grate with a loud clang.
He gave you your memories back, didn't he? He said. Then you know everything.
Not everything, said Kieran, and his voice cracked and broke. Mark thought of him hanging in the thorn manacles at the Unseelie Court, and how the same despair showed in his eyes now.
I don't know how you planned this. When you decided you would lie to me and get me to do what you wanted. I don't know how much of it sickened you every time you had to touch me to pretend to want me. I don't know when you planned to tell me the truth. After I testified? Did you plan to mock me and laugh at me before the council? Or wait until we were alone? Did you tell everyone what a monster I am, how selfish and how heartless?
You are not a monster, Kieran, Mark interrupted. There's nothing wrong with your heart.
There was only hurt in Kieran's eyes as he regarded Mark across the small space that separated them.
That cannot be true, he said. For you were my heart.
Stop!
It was Christina, her voice small and worried but firm.
Let Mark explain to you.
I am done with human explanations, said Kieran, and stalked from the room, slamming the door behind him.
The last of the shimmering portal disappeared. Julian and Magnus stood, almost shoulder to shoulder, watching Alec and the children until they vanished. With a sigh, Magnus tossed the end of his scarf over his shoulder and stalked across the room to fill a glass from the decanter of wine that rested dustily on a table by the window. It was nearly dark outside, the sky over London the color of pansy petals.
"Do you want some?"
he asked Julian, recapping the decanter.
"I should probably stay sober."
"Suit yourself."
Magnus picked up his wine glass and examined it. The light shining through it turned the liquid ruby red.
"Why are you helping us so much?" Julian asked.
"I mean, I know we're a likable family, but no one's that likable."
"No," Magnus agreed with a slight smile. "No one is."
"Then?"
Magnus took a sip of wine and shrugged. "Jace and Clary asked me to," he said. "And Jace is Alex Parabatai, and I've always had a fatherly feeling toward Clary. They're my friends, and there is little I wouldn't do for my friends."
"Is that really all of it?"
"You might remind me of someone."
"Me?" Julian was surprised. People rarely said that to him.
"Who do I remind you of?"
Magnus shook his head without answering.
"Years ago," he said, "I had a recurring dream about a city drowned in blood. Towers made of bones and blood running in the streets like water. I thought later that it was about the Dark War.
And, indeed, the dream vanished in the years after the war was fought. He drained his glass and set it down. But lately, I've been dreaming it again.